Hi, everybody, and welcome to Weird. I'm your host, Betty Bondage, and thank you guys all so much for tuning in. I am super fucking pumped about this endeavor. Somebody asked me if they could listen without headphones, and I was like, I don't think I'll be dropping too many F-bombs. I think it's like PG-13. And obviously that was a fucking lie. So I am so excited, to start talking about all weird stuff with you guys. I want to, talk mainly about, mysterious disappearances, cryptids, UFOs. I want to avoid talking about true crime because I don't think any human behavior is what I would call weird in terms of this podcast. It is certainly abhorrent oftentimes, but I don't think it's like fully aberrant. If a human has done it, it's part of human behavior because humans really do fucking suck sometimes. But yeah, that's kind of what I want to talk about today. And God willing, and the creek don't rise, every week. So thank you guys so much for joining me. If you're here because you're a consumer of my adult work, welcome. I hope you enjoy the new aspect of my creatordom. And if you're here because you're a friend of mine and you didn't know that I do adult work, you're probably not actually a friend of mine. No, I'm kidding. Welcome as well. I am very out about my sex work. It's not a surprise to anybody that matters. So, again, just kidding. I don't know what's listening. Anyways, so yeah, however you got here, welcome. And let's get right into it. I wanted to hit the ground running with something that really exemplified weird and what I want to do with this podcast. So today, we are talking about Point Pleasant's very own Mothman. So Mothman, right? He's a cryptid. If you're unfamiliar with the term cryptid, a cryptid is a sort of like an unverified animal. Bigfoot is a cryptid, and Loch Ness, that type of thing. Maybe locally you have your own version of a cryptid. I live in Massachusetts. It's where I was raised as well. We have a few. Connecticut has a few interesting ones, but basically it's just like a monster. There, of course, have been like new species recognized and identified, or maybe just like identified by white people and given like a white name. But anyways, like new species that's not what cryptids are generally. When we talk about cryptozoology, it's like weird ass shit, like fur bearing droughts, right? And actually, if you're in New England, there is a cryptozoology museum in Portland, Maine. So that is fun. Anyway, so Mothman. In order to talk about the story of Mothman, I think it's like interesting and important to discuss sort of the environment around the first sighting of Mothman. So Mothman was first seen in 1966, in November of 1966, in a small town called Point Pleasant in West Virginia. It's on the western edge of West Virginia, bordering Ohio. At the time, Point Pleasant was a really small town. 5,800 people, also only about like 3 miles from end to end, mostly little neighborhoods, not a huge area of commerce or anything like that. And today it's actually even smaller. It was like around 4,000 people that live there. It didn't shrink in size, which would be, you know, weird, or maybe just like eminent domain. I don't know. I don't know how that would happen, but, the town is small. It was small in 1966. It was also largely like families. A good portion of people were, you know, minors and family. They also had this thing called the fertility index. This is all the information that I'm gleaning off of the 1960 census, but they had this thing called the fertility index, which we still have a fertility index today, as far as I could tell. But at the time, what it meant was the number of birds, like the number of children under 5 per 1,000 women. And Point Pleasance was like 523. So they had like 52% of women between the ages of 15 and 59 had a kid under 5. So like Point Pleasantians were fucking, which is, you know, good to know. It was like, it was a small farm town, you know. I think a lot of times, like West Virginia, we think of mountains and hollers and like Shenandoah Falls and things like that. But this was more Ohio, right? It was more like cornfields and farms and things like that. It was an established community for a long time. It was actually like, there was a battle in 1775, with the indigenous peoples that, already populated the area. It resulted in, this really like fucked up situation where this chief that's often called Chief Cornstalk, but it looks like his actual name was Chief Hukulusqua. So in like 1777, he was actually murdered along with his son Elenipsico by soldiers as retaliation for something that somebody else did. They were being held captive, so they didn't actually enact this, like, whatever soldiers felt they needed to retaliate against. But they were murdered. And the reason that I bring this up isn't just because I want to give you a strange, weird, deep background on Point Pleasant. It's because years and years later, I think it was in the 1960s, they were getting ready to demolish an elementary school, and they found in a closet a play from the 1920s, like a community theater play, like written and put on by the people of Point Pleasant. And it described in it the chief's death, you know, his murder, and that with his dying breath, he cursed the area of Point Pleasant for 200 years. And so people were like, oh, okay, well, that's the reason all this fucked up shit happened. Which, like, probably that play is like shot through with all sorts of weird racist shit, and like exoticizing indigenous people. So A, that doesn't really, like, I'm not gonna trust that. It's not cursed, whatever. And then the other thing is, like, his tribe still lived nearby. Why would he curse the area? His family was still living there. Right? Like, it doesn't make any sense. Anyway, so yeah, the curse is, the belief in that is tenuous at best, I would say. Anyways, so, the town of Point Pleasant is, that's sort of like a good primer for them. It's just about 1.4 miles by road to Ohio. Very Ohio-ish, I think, in terms of like what we tend to think about, in terms of lots of farming versus, you know, Appalachia. Lots of having kids, lots of young kids, drag racing in the streets and stuff, being Utes and stuff. But Steep, speaking of, you know, kids and fucking and drag racing and stuff, let's get to this first Mothman sighting. In mid-November 1966 is when the first Mothman sighting happened. Two couples, Roger and Linda Scarberry, and Steve and Mary Mallett, they were driving in Roger's 1957 Chevy Bel Air through the roads of this wildlife preserve and bird sanctuary. It was known as the McClintock Wildlife Management Area. So it had been a game preserve before the Second World War. And then in the Second World War, the edge of the preserve was sort of co-opted to build a munitions complex. So people in the area called it the TNT area. By this time in 1966, it had long since been abandoned. It was like, you know, ruins. But it was basically a bunch of abandoned buildings and a sort of labyrinth of underground tunnels and then these like storage igloos where the munitions were stored before shipment. So I'm setting the stage here because even without a cryptid monster, this sounds creepy as fuck. You know, if you have an area in your where you live that's like a preserve or whatever, just imagine that. But at the edge of it is just this huge, like, munitions graveyard. So these two couples, these married couples, I think it was the Mallets that were, yeah, it was definitely the Mallets. They had just gotten married 5 months prior, but they were out together for a joyride. Clearly they were necking or involved in some sort of like lover's lane activity, or maybe they were showing the car off. I don't know. Who knows? Not me. Anyway, it was like between 11 and midnight. And as Roger is driving in this area, he's like pulling out of the preserve onto the main roads. The car's headlights hit these eyes in the bushes ahead. Of course, they don't immediately assume it's a monster. They think rationally that it's an animal. Like, the eyes are red, but sometimes that happens. Sort of a trick of the light situation. And besides, they only seemed to glow when the headlights hit them. So, not weird. So they pull out from the preserve onto the main drag, out onto the paved roads. And the thing is there again. And this is when they get, like, a good look at it. And it's not a raccoon or a fox. It's not even a giant buck or like a bear. Its form is like man-ish. It had muscular legs. Linda Scarberry said they were like a man's, which for whatever reason makes me think of this monster as sort of like a hockey player type. Like, I don't know if that's weird. It kind of sounds sexual. I'm probably making it sexual because I have a thing for like chunky hockey players. Maybe it's because, like, all the like, drawings of Mothman have him in, like, a hockey goalie pose, right? He's got, like, kind of, like, he's, like, squatting a little bit. He's got the legs out a little bit. Maybe that's it. I don't know. But I have a thing for chunky hockey players, so it explains why if I had to fuck a cryptid, it would be Mothman. This one time, I was shopping for jeans for my husband, because that's what happens when you get married, is that you go to Sears and shop for jeans for your husband. She was helping me pick out jeans for him, and I mentioned that he liked a slimmer fit, but he can't do the super skinny because he's got thicker thighs. And she directed me to, like, the skinny jeans for what she said was, like, hockey players. And honestly, looking back, I think she might have been a little thirsty for hockey players, too. She was, like, the quintessential mom that, like, when, like, calls people, like, a hot ticket and stuff like that. You know what I mean? I don't know. There's, like, a certain type of, like, 60-something-year-old New England mom that's just, like, horny. anyway, I don't know why I'm talking about this, but, you know, neither Mary nor Linda nor Roger or Steve found themselves aroused by this creature's thickly muscled hirsute quads, or if they were, they didn't say when they reported it to the police. They actually didn't say that it was hairy either. That was me editorializing. I like hairy guys too. Anyway, the creature's torso was human-ish, but that's like where the relative humanness ends. Attached to the creature's back, I believe as Linda Scarberry said, like, quote, like an angel, were these big wings. And they described it as having no arms, and then it was hard to see its face. Like, they weren't even sure if it had a head. The eyes, of course, weren't human. They were glowing red. They were 2 inches in diameter and 6 inches apart. And they were just peering out from the top of this foreboding 7-foot-tall creature. Linda mentioned not being able to see a head or arms at the time, but many years later, in 2001, in an interview, she claimed that it did have arms and that they watched it get caught on a fence and then free itself with its hands, and that she felt sorry for it. But at the time, all of the descriptions of this first encounter have them like, the women were hysterical. It says everywhere they were hysterical. All the women were hysterical. Which, like, fuck you. But, and the men were scared too, I'm sure. Anyway, I don't think that they actually watched the Mothman get caught in a fence, and we're not going to rely on eyewitness accounts from 35 years after the fact in this podcast. We just simply will not do that. We're going to stick to what was reported in the papers at the time, from police reports at the time of the incidents, things that were written closer to the events themselves, or things that use source material from the time. So when it raised its wings that night, they were nearly 10 feet in span, and when it flew, it didn't flap like a heron or flutter like a moth, despite its name. It moved effortlessly and very, very fast. The two couples were, as I said, they were terrified. So Roger floored it to get away from Mothman, but the beast kept up. And the couples estimated that they were traveling at 100 miles per hour and that it kept up with them. They saw it several times. They'd lose it for a few minutes, and then it would show up again. So this happened repeatedly, and finally they were able to lose the monster. And they went to the police. And see, this is one of the parts of the story that interests me, completely apart from the supernatural or even extraterrestrial explanations. And we will get to the extraterrestrial explanations. But this was two young couples going on a joyride at nearly midnight through a wildlife preserve / bird sanctuary / abandoned munitions complex. Like, clearly there was some necking, maybe some heavy petting occurring. And then they drove 100 miles per hour down this main strip of a tiny, like, 3-mile town. And then they went and told this all to the police. Like, what the fuck? Anyway, actually, there was like this, when I was like researching the story and looking at old newspaper clippings, I did find an article that I'm going to read to you now that addresses this like somewhat. And it also includes like some weird dog whistle type stuff. I don't know. It's not even dog whistle. It's like being screamed. It's weird. Anyway, so watch out for that, I guess, but it's honestly such a strange column, so we're just going to get right into it. It's called Technically Speaking. Okay, so, and it's an ongoing column, or it was, obviously not any longer, by a guy named Harry Peck, and again, it's called Technically Speaking. So the title of this column was, He Fears Mothman May Flee These Here Hills. Batman and Superman zoom, flash, and streak with Superdog, Robin, and Superboy across the TV and movie screens, and the pages of the comic books. To countless hundreds of thousands of Earthlings, these two super beings and their slightly less super sidekicks are commonplace. These are two well-identified flying objects. An illiterate Democrat might have difficulty distinguishing LBJ from Ronald Reagan, but he could spot Superman at a Republican rally. Batman would be recognized quicker at a convention of the NAACP than would Martin Luther King or Governor George Wallace. Yeah, he's Batman. What the fuck? Okay, all the world has costumed superhumans, flying saucers, rocket ships with little green men, and the numerous other identified and unidentified flying objects. We West Virginians can continue to hold our heads high with justified and inherent pride, because as in many other spheres, we are ahead of the rest of the world in the field of, quote, mysterious flying things. West Virginians have Mothman, discovered by West Virginians, for West Virginians, in West Virginia. He, she, it is huge and luminous, feathery and fuzzy, brownish gray and grayish brown, moth-like and bird-like, and he, she, it has large red reflector-like eyes that shine in the dark. No one knows what those eyes do in the daylight,
because no one as yet has sighted Mothman between sunup and sundown. Mothman is a racy rascal because he has been clocked at 100 miles per hour over West Virginia roads, and it's a cinch he could travel faster over the highways elsewhere. Mothman was first sighted several nights ago by two married couples in the vicinity of Point Pleasant as they drove and then fled along Mason County roads. Now here's where it gets, you know, there's a reason, I guess, that I'm reading it. No, I'm reading it because it's ridiculous. These four Mothmaneers were the ones who reported that he chased their automobile at the aforementioned 100 miles per hour. I'm inclined to believe most of their story because they were married couples. If they had been single couples, they would have been parked, and if they had been single and parked, they wouldn't have seen King Kong if he had wandered into the vicinity of their parked vehicles. So I'm convinced these two married couples were tailgated by West Virginia's Mothman. But what intrigues me is how they managed 100 miles per hour on Mason County roads. Mothman could manage it only because he is airborne. Later that same night, or perhaps it was the next night, a gentleman near Salem, a town in Massachusetts by the same name, once had witches. Was disturbed when his faithful bird dog named Bandit and his faithful television set named Westinghouse both began acting strangely at the same time. This Salemite opened his front door to investigate the outside distraction that was causing his two faithful friends to act so strangely. The owner of Bandit and Westinghouse saw a huge, fuzzy, feathery, luminous, flying object hovering nearby. Bandit saw Mothman too, and sped after what must have been the largest flying creature this bird dog had ever been close to. As of this writing, Bandit has not been seen again, but Westinghouse has regained its composure, and the gentleman from Salem would like to regain his bird dog. Just a day or two ago, the sheriff of one of the counties where Mothman has been flitting about tried to explain Mothman away by saying that our super-identified flying object was probably a bird called a shitepoke. I think any responsible lawman who would call a bird or Mothman or anything a shitepoke should be expelled from his high post. I only hope Mothman doesn't take offense at such a reckless, thoughtless remark, fly away from our hills, take up residence in New York, and get his own television series. It would be West Virginia's luck that the biggest boon the state has received since the days of the Braxton County Monster would be lost to us through the unholy alliance of a lawman and a bandit. You see what he did there? The lawman. The alliance between the cop who called Mothman a shitepoke and the dog that chased him. Get it? It's an unholy alliance. It's really funny. Yeah, so I just wanted to read that. Because, like, in addition to being, like, really weird with that political shit at the beginning, just fucking, God. He got a lot of it wrong. And we're going to kind of, like, we're going to kind of get into that a little bit. We're going to touch upon it, right? So this, like, but, you know, anyway, this weird 60s, like, Republican question mark acknowledges that it's only okay, or, like, believable because they're two married couples. And I think, like, despite his weird comments earlier, what he's saying is, like, that's ridiculous. It's sarcastic. But, you know, there are things that I encountered while I was, you know, researching this story that is basically the same thing. Basically, people were like, well, we believe it because these are good church-going folks, basically. But there actually is another sighting, like a necking couple in a car. Oh, also, I think it's weird that he's like, well, if they were married, they wouldn't be fucking. Also, they were, like, newlyweds, so they'd still be fucking, even in that, like, whatever belief that married people don't have sex for whatever reason. Anyway. So, yeah, there's another sighting. It's a necking couple in a car, and they consciously don't go to the police because they don't want to get in trouble for making out in cars in abandoned lots. So, that's not totally not the point of any of this, but that aside, this first sighting is what kicked off a series of Mothman sightings. And in the next 3 days, 8 sightings would be reported in Point Pleasant, ranging from, like, pretty mundane, like, oh, I think I saw something, to, like, experiences that were more menacing for the people that saw him. So, two young men, firefighters, I believe they were volunteer firefighters. I feel like there's like a corollary between firefighters and hockey players. Are they like the municipal corollary? I don't know. Are firefighters more the basketball? You know what? Moving on. So these two men reported that they saw the big red-eyed creature and that it was, quote, definitely a bird, which is, you know, this bird theory that we'll get into. But, and then, you know, another resident, same night as the married couple, might have been a day later. I'm repeating what Harry Peck said, because this is Newell Partridge, the man whose dog Bandit ran away to chase Mothman. And this is in one of the ways that Harry Peck is wrong in the column that he's writing. I know it's a satirical column, but like, if you're gonna be satirical, like, at least get the factual parts of it correct, you know? So anyway, so Newell Partridge says he saw some sort of apparition out in a field by his property in this meadow, and that he saw it shortly after his TV started acting up, was like a generator, making a noise like a generator, and then his dog started acting up, barking, his dog Bandit, and howling at the meadow by their house. So what he said was that when he went outside to investigate, he saw red twirling dots of light on the field, which he said in a recorded interview, he said they were definitely not eyes. So Bandit went to pursue these, like, weird twirling lights. He disappeared into the meadow, and he never returned. And then, also in the topic of weird news articles and what they include, Partridge's dog was noted in the article to be a German Shepherd, so, like, not a bird dog. I don't know. Are German Shepherds birding dogs? I kind of think more like curs and stuff like that. I don't know. Anyway, so a German Shepherd named Bandit... his dog was a German Shepherd named Bandit, right? So Harry Peck got that, who cost $350. The fuck? In the same article, it was noted that he was a contractor. So it would be like today you're reading an article about something that happened, and during that, somebody's dog disappeared, right? And it was like, you know, the Yorkie who went missing in the such and such area last week is named Snowflake, and it cost its owner, a bud tender / freelance journalist, $3,300. Like, what a strange array of information to provide. And then $3,300 is actually the cost of Bandit adjusted for inflation. So in today's dollars, Bandit was a $3,300 dog. Anyway, we're going to try to stay away from... discussions of economics and human pet relations, but I also think including the price of the dog is probably something to do with like the way people viewed pets then. I don't know. So anyway, Newell Partridge and several others, like these 8 sightings, the 3 days around the first sighting, were reported to the police. That first night with the couples, Officer Halstead took the report from the two couples, and he, you know, noted that they were, like, all good kids, people he had known for a long time, didn't get in trouble, and he trusted what they were saying, and that it was clear to him that they had gone through something. Then George Johnson, the Mason County Sheriff, which Harry Peck noted in his article, was the lawman who called the bird. He actually called him a, quote, freak shitepoke, which is this colloquial name for the green heron. You don't really hear shitepoke anymore, but hear shitpoke. People call, I've never heard a heron call a shitpoke, but people call cormorants shitpokes, shacks and cormorants. Anyway, this is again that like bird theory, which we will address. But there was another sighting, one of these sightings that was reported after the Scarberries and the Millettes. The sighting ran in the paper, but it actually preceded their run-in. As a man named Kenneth Duncan and 4 other men, they were digging a grave for Duncan's brother-in-law, which is interesting. Like, was that the tradition at the time, to dig graves for your loved ones, or did he happen to be a grave digger, and then his brother-in-law died? Like, I think I'd call out. you know. Like, I'm going to sit this one out. Anyway, so Duncan claimed he saw a, quote, brown man flying overhead while he was digging his brother-in-law's grave. The other four men that he was digging with, though, they all claimed they didn't see anything. And Duncan said that he saw it for a minute and a half. So why didn't anybody else see it? Perhaps because it was bullshit. Or it was part of the strange, like, miasma of the Mothman. Because, like, sightings of the Mothman weren't just people, like, seeing a thing and then telling the police or other people about it. It was much, there were a lot of, like, really visceral reactions to Mothman. Like, obviously, the two couples in the Scarberries and the Millettes in the Bel Air that night were scared. And the women were frequently described as hysterical. They did return to the area to try to see if they could see the Mothman again. And there was actually an article in the Athens Messenger 2 days afterwards on November 18th that said that the couples went back, and when they looked at the place that where Mothman was standing, they saw hoof prints. So now it's giant muscular quads with hooves at the bottom. So less of a hockey player and more of like a Pan type figure. You know, some sort of fawn beast, which is interesting. Or, you know, in the 36 to 48 hours between when that all happened and when they reported it and when they went back, someone rode a horse through the area. You know, farmlands, nature preserve, doesn't seem out of the realm of possibility. And just, there's other explanations. Anyway, moving on. So in the weeks following this, like, hundreds of sightseers joined the Millettes and the Scarberries in this, like, sort of watch at the TNT area. And Mrs. Millett, Mary Millett, was quoted as saying, "I hope others do see it. I hope it scares them as much as it did us. Maybe then they'll believe things exist and we're not dreaming." Which is, you know, when you think about it, like, if you saw something that was truly horrific and crazy, and you knew what you'd seen, but it was so fantastical that even saying it aloud, like, you could see people rolling their eyes, you know, inside their head, if they were had a good poker face, like, that would be extremely disheartening to just not be able to feel like you're believed. So I can understand wanting to go and look for it again, and then wanting that crowd with you to witness it too. And it was, like, a huge crowd. The descriptions that I read in the newspaper at the time, it's like, it sounded like a party almost. Like, young people, like, carrying on. The police were actually quoted as saying that they were nervous about the situation because they assumed that every car that was parked there accounted for at least one gun. And they were nervous about some sort of firearms accident. There was a rifle that was fired. And it did kind of seem like the gathering at the TNT factory waiting for Mothman was like kind of a hunt. You know, people waiting to see if they could shoot it, which I can understand. In a rural-ish area, you see a crazy beast, like, why not hunt it? Especially if you want to try to figure out what it is, right? But, thankfully, nobody with a gun saw it, the Mothman, and shot it. So, or not thankfully, I don't know. I don't know why I said thankfully. I'm not like a Mothman conservationist, but anyway. So, like, another cop was quoted as saying it was like a fair, like it was really like almost like a circus sideshow level interest in this. And I actually asked my dad, who was 15 at the time, if he remembers hearing about it. He didn't live in that area. He grew up north of Boston, but he said that he did. And I knew that it became like kind of a big story, especially with all the UFO stuff around it and the like larger context of all of the UFO sightings in general. So yeah, he said he'd heard about it. So it was like kind of a big deal. But there's, you know, another sort of quieter side to everything, you know, the part of it where residents of Point Pleasant found themselves coming sort of face to eyes with the Mothman in these quieter moments and feeling really drawn to it. Like they couldn't pull themselves away. They'd lose track of time and of their own will. And as they viewed the Mothman, there's this instance with a woman named Marcella Bennett, and she saw the Mothman behind her car one night while holding her infant daughter, and she said that she was so transfixed by the Mothman and his red glowing eyes that she dropped her baby on the ground and couldn't bring herself to pick it up off the ground. She couldn't pick her daughter up. Her daughter was crying on the ground. She's all dirty and she's like a little ground baby. And all Marcella could do was just stare into these glowing red eyes. There's another instance of a young woman named Connie Carpenter. She was 18 years old, and she was actually the daughter of a local reporter named Mary Heyer, which I'll mention her again a little later. But Connie saw Mothman while driving home from church at 10:30 in the morning. So there again is where Harry Peck is wrong, because Connie saw it during the day. But she too felt, you know, this draw to watch and like stare into the eyes of the Mothman. And about it, she said, once they were fixed on me, I couldn't take my eyes off them. And shortly after that, she developed pink eye. She developed a type of pink eye called Klieg conjunctivitis. And it may seem really weird that I'm bringing up the type of pink eye she got, but there actually is like kind of a precedent for people like getting pink eye when they encounter weird things. So basically the type of conjunctivitis that Connie had is from exposure to UV light. There's another, it's kind of like snow blindness. Snow blindness is something called photokeratitis that, it's an injury to the eye. It involves kind of a different part than conjunctivitis, but what she had was Klieg conjunctivitis and is caused by exposure to UV light. It's like kind of like a sunburn in your eyes. And what's interesting about that isn't just that she got this weird eye malady after seeing Mothman, but that this is actually fairly common in people who observe UFOs. So it's weird. there's something compelling about it. You know, there's a little bit of skepticism in me because the things that I've read from the time just say that she had pink eye, and then stuff that kind of was produced later said she had Klieg conjunctivitis. And there's no discussion of like, I went to the doctor and he was like, were you staring at the sun? Or like, were you arc welding without proper eye cure? Like, it feels like the doctor would be very surprised that an 18-year-old girl got Klieg conjunctivitis without any of the risk factors. Or that wouldn't be discussed as like some sort of, you know, veracity of the story. But I'm trying not to be too skeptical. I am generally an overt believer. So, but it, you know, it is interesting, the idea that she got some, you know, something became wrong with her eyes after she saw the Mothman. And what's also interesting is that the boy out of the couple of the couple that didn't report it to the police because they were making it in the car and they didn't want to get in trouble. They later spoke about how he got conjunctivitis afterwards. And if I recall correctly, his persisted for quite a bit, for quite some time. And this is actually also something that you may remember if you've watched, if you've recently watched the 2001 movie, The Mothman Prophecies with Richard Gere. In that the necking teenager has like, just like a fucked up eye. They don't say he has pink eye. It's like, it's also like pink eye is like such a not scary thing. You're like, oh, you got pink eye. Like, pink eye is just like something gross that like little kids who rub their eyes too much get. But anyway, that is in the movie. And one of the other dimensions that's included in the movie and that I would love to talk about is Indrid Cold. C-O-L-D. Indrid Cold. And this is where things turn away a bit from strictly Mothman sightings. Because the legend of Mothman is kind of all wrapped up with a bunch of other weird paranormal stuff. It's extraterrestrials and lost time and possible vampires and maybe fairies and then also men in black. But to get back to Indrid Cold, the weirdness in Point Pleasant in 1966 did start earlier than the Mothman, not by too much, but on November 2nd, 2 weeks before the first Mothman sighting, and just a day or so before the like grave digging sighting, which was the 3rd or the 4th, Virginia Thomas, this woman, was in her kitchen when she saw a huge something outside. It was a tall gray figure, and she described it as moving faster, like gliding and moving faster than any human being could move. And after that point, Virginia was like plagued by nightmares. And what's interesting is that in one of my sources, I read that Virginia Thomas was also known to have second sight, or ESP, like extrasensory perception. Do you guys, like, okay, so I grew up in the 90s, and I remember being a kid, and people used to say ESP all the time. Like, I feel like people don't say ESP anymore. Like, people would say it when someone was assuming something, you know, like, oh, what, do you have ESP or something, right? Maybe it was because of the X-Files. The X-Files talked about ESP a lot. You know what is true about the X-Files, the effect that it did have on the larger world, is that there was a marked increase in women entering STEM fields, and they called it the Scully effect. So that's neat. I bet Gillian Anderson feels good about that. And then, like, I started following, like, paranormal TikTok recently. And I've been seeing this hashtag, claircognizance. So maybe that's what ESP goes by now. Maybe the kids are, quipping about claircognizance now. So instead of clairvoyance, it's claircognizance. So it's a knowledge that you don't know where it came from. But anyway, I'm now very far afield and we're going to go back. Actually, no, we're not. We're going to briefly talk about ESP because I do have, a lens of skepticism over everything, but I do consider myself a believer in the paranormal. I'm just very skeptical about it. But I've always thought that many times when I read about ESP, it sounds like someone who just has very good intuition and very good deductive reasoning. And then I was listening to this episode of You're Wrong About, which is a really great podcast. And one of the hosts, Sarah Marshall, was talking about how women are often the ones who seem to have ESP, and it's often just, like, intuition. And I think that that take is really interesting. Like, people who are socialized female, who are raised to, or, like, socialized as women, raised to always be evaluating others' emotions and develop their emotional intelligence, particularly, often to the detriment of, like, their own needs, often are able to predict events based on that sort of innate knowledge of human behavior and how emotions play into decisions. And sometimes they can follow that many steps ahead, and it seems like almost magic, right? This is like not a, this is not like something that I've like come up with in my own head. Like Sherlock Holmes is just using deductive reasoning, but to many people that would seem like clairvoyance, like this impossible to know things. He knows them, right? And then when women do it, it's weird, and it's like you're a medium. Anyway, that's a total aside. Yeah, because Virginia was like, as I jump right back in, Virginia was like said to have like accurately predicted events that were going to happen in the area and things. And it's like, did she have ESP or did she just like put two and two together of seeing like a carnival, a state away in a town that was really a lot like Point Pleasant? And she, you know, picked up that from hearing people talk that they were headed west, and she was like, I bet they'll go here. And she was like, I feel like there's going to be a carnival. And then that was ESP. Like, I don't know. I don't know, man. Nobody knows. So the same night that Virginia saw this figure in her yard, because we are still on the topic of Indrid Cold, that same rainy November night, because of course it was rainy, this farmer named Woodrow Derenberger was driving at night to his home in Mineral Wells, which is about an hour's drive from Point Pleasant, when he saw a large gray, like, thing on the road ahead of me. And he says that he came to call this a ship. So it came up beside his truck, and it didn't have any lights. It wasn't really a vehicle so much as what he said it was like a machine, right? It was like a piece of machinery, which is like the creepiest way that I heard something described, like this gray machine. It's on a road, it's moving, it's coming to ride alongside you, and it's not a car, it's a machine. But the gray thing pulls ahead of him, and then it turns sideways, and it blocks his van, his Econo van. And once it stopped, a man came out. And once he got off, once this man disembarked, the machine rose up into the air, and it hovered about 50 to 100 feet above Woody's Econo van. And he said that the being was 5'10 to 5'11. And Woody weirdly pegged him at between 180 and 185 pounds, which seems like a really intensely small interval. That's like 1966, and it's like the weight of a thick wool coat. Seems weird. But he said that the man had thick, dark hair, and that it was slicked back, and he was very tan. And that comes up kind of again and again. It's like seeing weird figures that are very tan. But it was raining again, but the man just stood outside looking in at Woody and his van. And Woody claims that he felt a sort of like psychic message to roll his window down. And I find that like really funny, because like he felt compelled to roll his window down after someone approached his vehicle. Like, yeah, that's generally what you do when someone comes up to your car and looks at you. Like, maybe they want to talk to you. You roll your window down. I mean, at least, like, I imagine that's what white men do when other white men approach them. Even if he was very tan. I mean, I guess the argument is that, like, it was, like, a very strange situation. So why would you extend common courtesy to, like, some freak? I don't know. But it is really funny that, like, it's pointed to as some sort of proof of telepathically conveyed messages versus just like a conditioned response that most humans like would exhibit in this situation. But Woody rolls down his window, and the being tells him, "Do not be frightened. I want to speak with you. What is your name?" And Woody is so terrified that he can't respond. And the being tells him, "That's all right. He can think his answer if that's easier." Woody's still totally dumbstruck. He doesn't say anything. But the being replies, like, very, very rapidly, "Nice to meet you, Mr. Terenberger." So it's a two-way street, which is nice. You know, it's very egalitarian. And what I'm going to do now is I'm going to read verbatim from Woodrow Derenberger's self-published book. It's insane that this wasn't, you know, picked up by a major house, but it's called Visitors from Lenulus. Okay. He said that his name was Colt. He then asked me if I worked for a living and if I had to. I told him yes, and that I was a salesman. He then said that he was a searcher. He again told me that I should not be frightened and that he wished me no harm, only happiness. He had a very pleasant smile on his face, and his arms were folded, with his hands tucked under his armpits. He then asked me what the lights in the distance were, and although he did not point, he did give me the mental impression that he was. I knew the direction about which he was inquiring. I told him that it was Parkersburg, a city. He asked me if all the people lived there, and I told him that it was a place of business and of trade, and that most of the people lived in outlying areas, or the suburbs. He told me that where he was from, such a place was called a gathering. He then said, "Mr. Derenberger, look at me. I am the same as you. I sleep and breathe and bleed, even as you do." What? And, you know, then he, like, went on to reassure Woody that he didn't mean him any harm, and he told him that he should go to the police and he should tell him what happened. And he told him that he was going to come back and visit him again. So Woody goes home, and he tells his wife about what happened, and his wife's like, all right, let's call the police. He's too nervous to do it, so Catherine calls, and he relays everything to her, and she tells the police. And the police tell the couple that two other men had reported being stopped in the same manner on the same highway, which is crazy. To have that type of documentation and corroboration between individuals who'd never met. Super weird. There was a ton of people that actually, like, either saw him talk. There were two people, I believe there were two people that saw him talking to Indrid Colt. And there were other people that witnessed the ship on the highway. I tried to find any copies, like actual mimeographed copies of a police report around these sightings, but I wasn't successful in doing that. The two men, the other men that saw this, did talk to another figure whose name you will undoubtedly encounter if you like strange things, and particularly if you're curious about Mothman sightings. This man's name is John Keel. He's a very well-known author, or he was. He's definitely dead. He's an ufologist, so UFOologist, self-described magic hobbyist, and my favorite one, a, quote, amateur hypnotist. And he has this super strange, unwavering penchant for describing every woman he writes about in the most bonkers 60s white dude way. He calls Connie Carpenter, the girl with pink eye, he describes her as being so thin that she would never win a Raquel Welch lookalike contest. I was like, did they have those? Why would they have those? Why would she need to? Why is this your benchmark? My other favorite one, and I think this is like, I don't ever want to be a divorcee, but he calls this woman a lithe divorcee, which I'm like, that's fucking amazing. I just imagine her in like a leopard print catsuit, like lithe divorcee, and like she's smoking a cigarette and she's like fine being single. Anyway, she's probably fucking one of those hockey player fucking firefighters in town. Okay, anyway, so what's even more amazing, and by amazing I mean fucking shitty, and what actually pertains to Indrid Cold, is that when he's talking about interviewing a family who witnessed Indrid Cold's ship on the same night, he mentions that they are reputable sources because they're all above average income and intelligence. So that's cool. So similar to Harry Peck. See, this is where I'm like, Harry Peck, are you making fun of people that say stuff like that? Like,
You're all over the place with what you're saying, man. Anyway, yeah, so he claims that because they're above average income, he basically is saying you can't trust the poor's. So, you know. So anyway, John Keel wrote the book, The Mothman Prophecies, from which the movie draws its name and very little else. There's actually a character in the movie called Alexander Leake, which is just Keel backwards. And then the main character is a writer whose name is John Klein. So if you smush them together and reverse some of it, you get John Keel. But if you aren't aware of the Men in Black, which is like kind of the three core tenets of the Mothman processes, is it's about Mothman, it's about Indrid Cold and extraterrestrials, and it's about Men in Black. So Men in Black are, just to give you like a brief summary, they are men dressed in black suits who either claim to be working for or with the government, or sometimes who claim no allegiance, who visit UFO and extraterrestrial contactees and interrogate or intimidate or assassinate them. And then in the Mothman Prophecies, John Keel does this thing where he sort of just like drops in descriptions of like, quote, strange men dressed strangely. And then sometimes they're not dressed strangely. Sometimes they're in ill-fitting suits, and sometimes their suits are really nice. And sometimes they speak English very well, and sometimes they can't speak at all. There is very little continuity between these people, but there is the common thread that these men do seem to genuinely be duplicitous. Like some of them claim to know him and he definitely doesn't recognize them. Some of them claim to know him at one point in like an evening or an interrogation session, and then later claim that they don't know him. Some of them seem to be trying to gather information on him. And again, this is coming from him. So it's like, are you a fucking egomaniac, man? Like, you describe most women based on like their boobs and like describe women as like sparrows. Like, you're fucking weird. So, you know, grain of salt and all that, you know. But I'm sort of inclined to believe that they are all just like amateur ufologists. I don't know what makes someone like a pro ufologist. Maybe it's just like a MUFON membership. But to me, it's like these people just seem like they're amateur ufologists, people interested in the strange who have really bad social skills, or else like good social skills and shitty disguises, or like bad social skills, good disguises, and like maybe don't speak English very well. Because like, here's the thing. As someone who essentially cosplays for a living, wardrobe is really hard to nail down like super duper well. There's a reason that people are paid to do that for movies, to really sell it. If you're faking it and you don't know the sort of like minute details of dress and carriage of the person that you're imitating, like people will see through that. And really what you need to do is pass on a level of like layman's understanding. Like if you're pretending to be a man from the government, you just need to be able to you don't have to be able to trick another person in the government. You just need to be able to trick a random civilian. But that's also part of why it's such compelling evidence for the Men in Black being extraterrestrials, right? So these like civilians can tell that these imposters aren't from the government, or they're off, or they're maybe from another world. Like, why can't the imposters do a better job if they're human? They should be able to match another human in the ability to like mimic, right? But if they can't, maybe it's because they don't have a lifetime of living, you know, on Earth or as humans to gather together bits of information on how these things work or how people perceive things and how to imitate that. Or that's all total fucking bullshit. Like, who's to fucking say?
I will say that the Men in Black are often described by Kiel in like very outdated terms. So if you're going to read that, just heads up. He basically just is like uses super outdated terms that were, I'm sure, offensive even then. And then he also is like keeps saying that like there are these individuals people see that are like deeply tanned, very dark skinned, but all the witnesses swear that they don't have like the features of a black person. And it's like, it's 1966 in West Virginia. Your town has 5,800 people. Have you seen anyone from Eritrea, Egypt? Like, have you seen all black people? You know, there's like a lot of different features. it's wild. Now, one thing that I do feel like I agree with John Kiel on is that I think the whole UFO craze wasn't about UFOs, wasn't really UFOs. And I think that's, you know, true about Mothman too. I don't think Mothman was related to UFOs. I think UFOs were what was on trend. And when things happened that people couldn't explain, there was a sort of crowdsourced explanation that pulled things in from, you know, popular culture and the zeitgeist around weird stuff, you know. John Kiel actually takes it a step forward and claims that these apparitions in their, like, myriad forms are tulpas, which is a super interesting idea. I won't go too deep into that, but I think, because I think, like, I think I might do a full tulpa episode in the future if this all works out well, but a brief sort of definition is, like, a tulpa is basically an entity that's created through thought, like, through spiritual or psychic forces. Some people call them thought forms. So basically, like, humans invented these phenomena. They invented them through their minds. And Kiel says, he puts it in his introduction to the Mothman Prophecies regarding the existence of extraterrestrials. He says, quote, "The presence of these objects and beings is a normal condition for this planet. These things either reside here but somehow remain concealed for us, or they do not exist at all and are actually special aberrations of the human mind, tulpas, hallucinations, psychological constructs, momentary materializations of energy from that dimension beyond the reach of our senses, and even beyond the reaches of our scientific instruments. They are not from outer space. There is no need for them to be. They have always been here." Like, I kind of agree with that. Like, you're a weird dude, but yeah. And it's still, like, kind of batshit crazy, but, like, it's not little green men, you know? Little green men on, like, flying saucers and stuff. That's just what science fiction and you know, space exploration made us collectively think of at the time of these, like, rampant flaps, which, if you don't know what a flap is, it's sort of the officially accepted term for a group of UFO sightings. So it's like a parliament of owls or whatever. Like, a group of UFO sightings is called a flap. But anyways, like, I do tend to agree with this. I think there's things that don't have explanation that can't be explained. And I think the human brain is as unknown as the unexplored and deepest parts of the ocean. Like, you think that should we just don't understand it and we can't see parts of what our brains do. And I, you know, I think there are things in our own consciousness and our collective unconscious that defy current explanation or reason completely. On the other side of that, in terms of explanation, is the people who believe that the Mothman was a bird. So I mentioned it before, but and this doesn't do much to explain, you know, Indrid Cold and his ship, but I would imagine that people who believe that the Mothman must have a rational explanation probably also just assume everyone else was lying about Indrid Cold and his machine. But, you know, I'm a birder. I've handled and banded a couple of different types of birds, one of which has a 5.5-foot wingspan, right? So the heron that people claim Mothman is, the like specific like shitepoke, is a green heron and has a 28-inch wingspan. So they, you know, the sheriff of the county was like, it's a freak shitepoke. And like a bunch of people were like, it's a mutant because it's from the chemical factory or something. It's like, that's not how mutation works. Also, no. But what? Also, like, they're called shitepokes or shitpokes because, like, poke as in bag, not the act of poking someone. So a shit bag, because when you flush them, like when you scare them, which you do a lot because they're super skittish, they don't chase cars, they defecate, they shit everywhere. So I feel like if Mothman, every time Mothman took off, they were like, ah, shit everywhere. Like that would make its way into some of the sightings, right? But no one mentioned that. And I wouldn't say they like squeak like a mouse, which is how the Scarberries and Millettes describe them. And that seems weird. Anyway, so the other bird, possible bird is that people cite as being an explanation for Mothman is the sandhill crane. And this is like pretty compelling because sandhill cranes have a wingspan of over 6 feet. Like that's huge. It's not 10 to 12 feet big, but again, eyewitness accounts are like anything but reliable. They are reliable only in that they are reliably unreliable. So like, who knows what's real and what's exaggerated, but even the sandhill crane, and the sandhill crane has like, it has red eyes, but they're not 2 inches in diameter. They're not 6 feet apart on its head. It has like a red bare area around its eyes and up onto its head. But it's definitely doesn't, it has like, it has crane legs. It doesn't have like muscly hot hockey player legs. But like whenever it was, it, or like a variation on that theme, was seen over and over again in the coming 13 months. And John Keel went to West Virginia a ton. And he worked closely with Mary Heyer, Connie Carpenter's aunt. She was, again, as I said, she was a writer for the local paper. And she was covering UFO stuff. She was working with John Keel. They were investigating things. They were interviewing people constantly. I can't recommend Mothman Prophecies because there's like a lot of it that's really ridiculous. But it's a very quick way to get a lot of the firsthand, like primary source information on Mothman and Indrid Cold. So it like serves that purpose. But all that to say, all of this work culminated in on December 15th of 1967, the Silver Bridge, which spanned the Ohio River from the from Point Pleasant over, it was loaded to with cars. The traffic light wasn't on. The bridge became overloaded. There was some faulty components, and it collapsed, sending cars straight into the Ohio River and killing 46 people. And that was when the Mothman sightings ended. In the documentary, The Mothman of Point Pleasant, which is directed and written by Seth Breedlove and co-written by Lyle Blackburn, and I would recommend it. It's got really great recorded interviews, both present day and from the time of the Mothman sightings. But they interview the head of the tourism department for Mason County, a man named Denny Bellamy. And he said that after the bridge collapse, quote, no one wanted to hear about the Mothman anymore. And that's sort of, you know, the sort of like imaginative play, like fantasy, you know, helping to crowdsource a tulpa as a pastime in a small town. It sounds weird to say it, but it is a luxury. We can't afford to imagine monsters when horrific things are happening. This bridge collapsed and 46 people died in a community of just 5,800. So of course the Mothman disappeared. And that is where our story ends today. That's all I got to say about the Mothman, you know? So, what do you think? Are those red eyes in the night a warning? Not a bird, but a harbinger, a bringer of prophecies, or a bringer of doom? Is it an extraterrestrial? Maybe it's a tulpa. Maybe. Stranger things have happened, and I'll be sure to tell you all about them next time on Weird.